This is just wonderful to be here, and thank you very much for coming. Okay, so I'm writing a book. The book's called Fishing for Fools with Robert Schiller, and I very much welcome your comments. I gave very much the same talk to the Warwick Economics Summit last year, and I think that the people there liked it, so I'll continue. So I'm going to begin the talk with a small model. Actually, if you haven't read The Market for Lemons, please stay, because I'm going to go over it. So that's going to be the beginning of the talk. So that's going to be the beginning of a paper that I've written with Hui Tong at the IMF. And that paper that we're going to talk about will motivate what comes later. And so that will just be the beginning of the lecture. And then the rest of the lecture will be on the book with Bob Schiller. Now, the book with Bob Schiller is meant to be a popular book. And there are two motivations for that. The first is, despite what people in academia say, I think that we're influenced more than we think by popular books. And the public and economists have too great an acceptance. That's the first reason. The second reason is, I think the public and economists have too great an acceptance of the view that whatever markets do is right. There are people who are skeptics, but I think that is, in fact, a fairly general view. Of course, all of us, everybody would take into account the standard externalities. But that, as we're going to see, does not exhaust the reason why markets yield bad outcomes. So we're going to explore the notions that something that markets do is they fish for fools. Fish with a PH, fools with a PH. Now, all economists know this. Everybody here in this room knows this. But then that leads to the second very general motivation. The rule of what can and cannot be published in economics simply leaves holes. There are some perfectly valid and important things to say, but there's no way to say them that would be acceptable in any economic journal. For example, just to give one example, but this is a very important example, quite a few economists thought the derivatives would lead to the current crisis. But economists could not figure out a way to express these views in the form of a paper. So I believe that fishing for fools is one of those holes in economics, because we all know it, it cannot be published. But then, because it cannot be published in journal form, it turns out it gets ignored, even at the highest levels of policy. And especially because it was ignored, we had the financial crisis, and that, I think, is the central event in the economic history of our times. Okay, so with this prefatory note, let me begin. I'm going to begin with a very elementary model. The model that I'm going to give you is going to be an extension of The Market for Lemons, which I wrote many years ago, and I'm going to review The Market for Lemons here. What we're going to find is that with a small change in that model, what we'll find is fishing for fools. That was going to mean that everything that I say later is not just gibberish. It means that there's a precise interpretation of what that means. So let's begin with a review of that original paper. On that paper, there was asymmetric information. And then buyers and sellers had rational expectations. The questions that were asked in that paper was twofold. One was, what were the consequences of the asymmetric information for the volume of trade? And the second was, what were the consequences for welfare? Okay, so I'm going to review the original model, which you may know. So first let me describe the sellers. It's a market for used cars, so they're used cars. Those used cars differ in quality. That quality is uniformly distributed between 0 and 2. All of these used cars are initially owned by the sellers, and the sellers get $1 worth of utility from one quality unit of used cars. The sellers know the quality of their car, their used car. The buyers, the potential buyers, do not. So there's the utility of the sellers. They get, I think we'll come back to that. So now I'll describe the buyers. There are also potential buyers of used cars. Those potential buyers get $3/2 worth of utility from one quality unit of used cars. And then the buyers here, this is the key assumption for what we're going to talk about now, have rational expectations. They have rational expectations about the distribution of quality of used cars that are going to be sold. So here is the formal model. The formal model is as follows. We have the utility of the sellers. Their utility depends upon M, which is money, and the quality units of used cars that they get, where XI is the quality units of the ith car that they own. Now, the key thing to note here is that the sellers get one unit of utility from one unit of used car sold, and then in contrast, the buyers get 3/2 unit of utility from one unit of used car quality. Okay. So you all know what this looks like. If the buyers and sellers have the same information, usually all of the used cars will be sold to the seller by the sellers to the potential buyers. Why? For a simple reason, because the buyers value quality units at 3/2 and the sellers value them at 1, and such trade is what a free market will produce if buyers have sufficient income. Okay? So I've reviewed the assumptions. Now let's talk about the equilibrium. I want you to pay a little bit of attention to this equilibrium, even if you know it, because I'm going to use it when we go to a slightly more complicated example. So what does our model produce when there's asymmetric information? And I'm going to review that. And the equilibrium is that there's no equilibrium trade at any price. And the question is, why not? Let's go through the analysis. So we're going to make a proof by contradiction. We will show that there will not be trade at any positive price for used car P. Okay? So let's go over that logic. Suppose there is a price P. Let's first examine the sellers and the cars they're going to offer. Well, at the price P, sellers will offer all those cars that have quality less than P, so they'll keep all cars between P and 2. So since all cars have a uniform distribution, that means that the average quality of used cars that they're going to put on the market is 1/2 of that P, and so the average quality of cars is P over 2. Okay? That's going to be the average quality of cars offered at price P. So now let's examine the buyers. Will anyone be willing to buy at this price P? And the answer is no. Why not? The expected use value to a buyer will be 3/2 times the expected quality of the used car she's going to get. Okay? Her expected use value from a used car purchase, if the price of the car is P, will then be 3/2 times P over 2, where P of 2 is, of course, the expected average quality she's going to get. So that's what she's going to get if she pays the price P for the car. So her expected net gain in utility from purchasing a car is going to be 3/2 times P over 2, or 3/4 P, minus P, which is minus 1/4 P. This means the following. It means that there's no positive price P at which it pays a buyer to purchase a car. So there's no gain to the buyer at any positive price. There's going to be no trade at all. Trade, therefore, disappears because of the asymmetric information. Okay, so that's the market for lemons. And this is also the original model, which is actually quite useful. So I reviewed this example, which some of you may know, because it sets the backdrop. It sets the backdrop for an alternative model. This new model has only a slight change of assumption, and yet it yields quite different results. Let's assume, again, that there's asymmetric information, but let's assume that the buyers do not have rational expectations. Instead, let's suppose that they're naive. In the case we're going to consider, buyers do not perceive that there's going to be this adverse selection. They're not that sophisticated. What buyers think is they think that sellers will offer cars randomly by quality between 0 and 2. Okay. So let's now examine the new equilibrium and see what's going to happen. To do so, first let's see what the buyers are going to do. Okay. So specifically, the buyers think that the quality of cars offered will be distributed uniformly between 0 and 2. They then expect that the average quality of the car they're going to buy is going to be 1. Okay? That means that if they have sufficient income, they will be willing to buy any number of cars at the price of 3/2. Okay? So they think the average quality is 1. They get 3/2 unit of utility per quality unit, so they're willing to pay 3/2. They're not going to buy, but they're not going to buy any cars at a price above that price, above 3/2. Okay, so let's think about 3/2. So, and now let's think about the sellers. At that price of 3/2, we can also infer what the sellers will do. Their utility from a quality unit of car is 1. And remember that the sellers know the quality of the car they own. So at the price of 3/2, they will sell any car with quality less than 3/2. Okay? And correspondingly, they're going to keep any car with quality between 3/2 and 2. So the switch from rational expectations to quality makes a difference, and we'll now see that in the new equilibrium. So the equilibrium where supply equals demand is at a price of 3/2 if the number of used cars n is sufficiently small. So as long as that's not big, we're going to get an equilibrium at a price of 3/2. And in this equilibrium, all cars between 0 and 3/2 are going to be offered for sale. And so what does that mean? What that means is, let's go to see where we're going to go. In the model with rational expectations, remember, trade disappeared. Now in the new model with naivete, what we're going to find is the trade has reappeared. But there's also a major difference in terms of the welfare. In the old market for lemons with rational expectations, the potential buyers did not trade. And since they did not trade, they did not lose. But this naive version of the lemons model, the buyers do trade. They're willing to pay price of 3/2, and then the sellers are willing to sell to them all cars they have of quality less than 3/2. So the buyers are willing to trade. They do trade. And then, in fact, what we find is they lose. As before, they pay a price P. If they pay a price P, they're going to get expected quality of P over 2. There's no reason that changed. And so with their utility function, which it values this expected quality at 3/2 times P over 2, they are again going to lose P over 4, just as before. So they're going to, the price is 3/2, and they're going to lose 1/4 of that. They're going to lose 3/8. So what's the conclusion? Now let's draw some conclusions of that, and then we'll see whether that has some practical implications, maybe for my life, maybe for yours. We'll just see whether that's the case. So in this model where there's naivete, markets do not benefit the buyers. Every buyer, all these buyers are out there buying, and they are losing P over 4 for every car that they buy. Instead, what we find is markets play a dual role. They play a dual role in people's lives. 1/3 of the buyers who get cars of quality between 0 and 1, they are going to lose. And then, 1/3 of the buyers who get cars between 1 and 3/2, they're going to gain. But then those people who are unlucky, who get cars between 0 and 1, which is 2/3 of the buyers, they're going to lose. And on average, as I said before, the buyers are going to lose P over 4 for every car that they buy. So what does this show? It shows in a very simple example, this is a very simple example, something that everybody in this room knows. It shows that markets serve two purposes. They serve a positive purpose of letting people trade according to their comparative advantage. That's this difference between three halves and one. But it also shows something else. It shows that if people are naive, markets will take advantage of them. Because of their naivete, they will suffer a loss of welfare. So this small mathematical example then serves as an introduction to this lecture. It's the basic theory behind fishing for fools. So I've given you this model as motivation because it underlies everything that will follow. So this is both an early trial run of the work with Hui and also the book that I'm trying to write with Bob. So that's the mathematical model. You're going to see no more mathematical models. We're going to have a switch into popular node. And I hope that there are going to be some important lessons from the model. Okay, so let's see what happens next. So it's almost a law of nature. From nuclear generators to chainsaws, our most powerful tools are also the most dangerous. Okay. The world's most powerful social and economic tool is the free global market. That really is important, and it probably does benefit us a great deal. We should not deny that. So what it does, it enables the world's adults, all of them, to trade with one another. So worldwide, there are 25 quinquillion possible pairs of buyers and sellers. And a quinquillion is actually a very large number. That's what a quinquillion is. Let me see whether I have the right number of zeros. 1, 2, 3. I think I have three too many. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I have three too many. No, I don't. No, I got it right. Okay, yeah. So there's million, billion, trillion, quadrillion, quinquillion. Yes, I got it right. All right, so that you can see that a quinquillion, and that is the number of pairs of people, of adults, who can possibly trade. The selection that this huge amount of choice affords to both buyers and sellers makes us all better off. But that's just the beginning of the power of markets. Markets are beneficial for another reason. Why? Because anyone with an idea regarding how they can offer a better deal quite possibly can make a profit on it. And such ideas will be selectively sought out and they will be adopted. So, over the course of the last century, if each one of us had had only one such idea once a month, 4 trillion new ideas would have been generated. And that's a lot of ideas. You know, you don't have to select all 4 trillion. Even if you select 1 million of them, you're still going to get a lot of changes. So the selective adoption of the best of these new ideas, as allowed by the free market, has had powerful effect. So over our lifetimes, we will see a lot of change. Mainly because of these new ideas, our standard of living will go up something like sixfold over our lifetimes. So just to give you an image, a US-based image, for example, in the older US, in the US, our older retirees, those over the age of 80, were born in a country that was poorer than present-day Mexico. So this really makes a big difference, this huge amount of ideas. Okay, so that's what everybody knows. This is Paul Romer, I think. That's my version of Paul Romer. Okay. But if markets are capable of such good power for good because they allow so much positive selection, but they can also allow a great deal of harm because they also allow for negative selection. Not all of those 4 trillion ideas are good for you and good for me. Some of them are good for you and they're bad for me. And associated with such ideas come the tricks to inveigle me into buying in. Thus, free markets do not just produce good for you, good for me. They also do produce something else. And we got to think about that something else. It's just amazing. I'm writing this book, you know, I never thought about this before, that one assumes only that that technology frontier goes outward and all of that stuff is good. Think about all that stuff is that some of that stuff, some of it, not all of it, might be bad. Okay, so markets also systematically aim for our weak spots. They seek out and take aim. They take aim for our emotional or cognitive weaknesses. And they also do something else. They seek to block our channels of information and then take advantage of those weaknesses. And then they seek out and take advantage of our failures to understand that we don't know what we don't know. So what does that mean? That takes us to the title of the talk. It means that markets enable fishing for fools. Okay. So fishing, what is fishing? So fish is a recent word. It's computerese. Free markets open us up to those who seek to influence us to do what they want, but that's not necessarily good for ourselves. They allow us, in other words, to be fished. So we live in a world, as we've been pointed out before, where some 5 billion adults can fish us for being a fool. So we've intentionally opened ourselves up to such exploitation because of the obvious advantages. But then we must also think about the other side of that bargain. Okay, so fools, what's a fool? What's a fool with a PH? Fool is a new word. A fool is simply someone who is successfully fished. That's our definition. A fool with a PH can be a perfectly intelligent person. He need not be a fool with an F, who's defined by the dictionary of being silly and unintelligent. Instead, he's more likely to be someone who acts on his instincts in making decisions, and sometimes those instincts just happen not to be right. And then, of course, if you happen to have those instincts, it's no coincidence that there's that whatever it is that just happens to be there to take advantage of it. That's what capitalism's going to produce. So let's be a little bit careful. Let's not overdraw what we're saying. Fishing for fools probably has relatively little effect on us when we're aware of it. So the example of fishing on the computer serves probably pretty well here. Occasionally one or another of us gets hooked in a fish. I probably, with this audience here, but probably some of you who have on occasion gotten yourself in some kind of fish, or I think you may know somebody who's gotten fished. There are estimates for the United States which range from 0.6 million a year to 3.6 million per year. And I'm not going to vouch for the validity of those estimates, but that gives you sort of a rough order of magnitude. That presumably is enough to keep the fishers in business. But compared to, say, the number of and the cost of auto accidents, it's relatively minor. Why? Because we now know about computer phishing, and we have our virus programs, and we guard against it. So that is, I think, a minor nuisance. So what happens if we ignore the fish? What would happen if we did not know about the fish? What would happen if we denied it because that was a part of our constitutional makeup? Or if we denied it because we'd been sold a bad bit of intellectual goods which said that free markets like the internet always invariably give us what we want because we are free to choose? Then fishing could have a major impact. So I'm going to give you three examples. But actually, I think as Bob and I have been working on it, we're coming up with other examples, and this type of thing really does have serious impacts on the lives we lead, and I'll come back to that at the end. So here are three examples. Health. So in the United States, 3/4 of all adults are overweight. Yet worse, not only are people overweight, but a third are supposedly obese, according to the CDC definitions. Now, obese seems to me to be a serious problem. Does the market help us with this problem? Well, the market does help us with this problem. We can go to Weight Watchers. We can drink Diet Coke. We might even drink Diet Pepsi. or we can eat vegetables. So that's some help for all of us who are concerned about our weight. But if you go to almost any mall, any place in the United States, and you can find some of these in Britain, so I don't know if you probably have seen them, you will find the following. There will be the smells of those things called Cinnabons. Do people here know what Cinnabons is? Well, there's a cinnamon, sticky cinnamon buns. And it's they chose that cinnamon. You know, they went actually all the way to Malaysia to choose a special brand of cinnamon. And it's no coincidence that when you're out there in the mall, like where Avenay is, and you go to where Robbie is, that he's going to smell that cinnamon because it turns out that the cinnamon attracts you just like a moth is attracted to its pheromones. So you may buy that cinnamon and then say, oh my God, I crashed my diet of 2 months. But it was arranged, and because it was no coincidence it was there. And it's no coincidence that poor Robbie is out there eating his cinnamon bun and it's dripping with that stuff, okay? So that smell, like a wasp's pheromones, is a call to all of us overweight, obese people. And it is doing a fish for fools. Let's just give what that means in terms of the United States. In 1970, at which point one would think that the United States was probably pretty well fed, between 1970 and 2003, the U.S. daily food calorie intake increased by 23.4%. And 480 of those, that 423 calorie increase were in unhealthy foods, that is in fats and grains and sugar and sweeteners and so forth. And so Cinnabon, I shouldn't pick on Cinnabon, it's just an example. But this is also a metaphor for a general, more general market, general phenomena of the temptations that the market strews in our path. So now I'm going to give you two more examples. People save too little because they're constantly tempted. And we're going to come back to this later in detail. And then there's example three, which is the Great Recession. The Great Recession was caused by fishing for fools. And I'll come back to that. Okay. So what are the general consequences? We've cited just three examples of the consequences of fishing for fools and the perils we run if we ignore it. So the book is going to explore these examples in much more detail and also many others. Okay, so that's the introductory chapter. I'm now going to go in this sort of chapter by chapter. So second chapter, Advantage Fisher or Advantage Fools. I'm going to skip this chapter, which describes the advantages of fishers and the weaknesses of the fools. So the thing is that the fishers really do have a lot of advantages. They have the advantage that there are 5 billion people out there to whom to fish. And then those 5 billion people have, it depends upon how you describe it, but we have probably there are hundreds of ways in which we can be tricked by one criterion. There are 100 sort of categories of behavioral ways in which we deviate from what most of us would call rationality. Not to count all of the informational ways in which you can fail to give people information which they don't notice. So that's that chapter. Okay, now I'm going to go to chapter 3. And I'm only going to summarize chapter 3. Okay, that describes the history leading up to the Meat Inspection Act of 1906 and the Pure Food and Drugs Act of 1906. Now, what's the reason for that? There are all these people who say, no, regulation's the most awful thing in the world and we shouldn't have it. There's a simple proof that somehow that's just not the case. Go back to the 19th century and think about the world without regulation and, you know, nobody I know would want to go back to that world, especially in the terms of regulation on food and drugs. So I'm going to summarize that in two pictures. Okay, so this is, I don't know whether you can see it, this is the label for Swaim's Panacea, and it was offered in the 19th century. It promised, not necessarily believable, to cure almost every illness. Instead, it didn't do that. It contained mercury, and it killed people. So you had one good thing if you had Swaim's. You had that nice Hercules on your side, and he could swat almost anything, including those terrible snakes. Okay. Now I'm going to give you another label, and here we get sort of the same thing. That's Bradham's Micro Killer. So what did Radom's microkiller do? It mainly contained water and dilute muriatic acid. So it probably had relatively few bad side effects. It wasn't as bad as Swain. But it did have one good side effect, at least for the person who invented it. Radom, who had been a gardener in Austin, Texas, made a fortune, and he moved to a mansion on Fifth Avenue. Okay. So the thing is, then, of course, we now have at least some regulation of food and drugs, and we eat our food, and we can go to the drugstore counter, and we can still be fished, but we're certainly not as can't be fished as badly as would have as occurred in the 19th century. Okay, so that's chapter 3. Let's go to chapter 4. Okay, so there she is. Okay, now, this is Susie Orman. Now, I'm not sure that everybody here knows who Susie Orman is, but everyone in the United States knows who Susie Orman is. And she's a financial advice person who was very popular on PBS and now has a weekly show on CBS, I think. So when I asked an economist friend, you get the picture of what Susie Orman is like. I said, this is... So when I asked an economist friend of mine about her, he had the predictable reaction. He had watched her for only 10 seconds. He said he could not stand her mommy knows best voice, and also he found her investment advice simplistic. But that, in fact, raises a puzzle, because you watch this TV show, and she has these adoring audiences. And if she's so terrible, she is like this, and if she's so simplistic, what are they doing listening to her and giving her this enormous claps and being so adoring? Okay.
Can you tell us a bit? Most people, I think, have no idea who she is.
Okay.
Give us a little flavor of it.
I think the picture. Take the picture. Take the picture, and then you have somebody who gives very simplistic financial advice. Okay, that's basically it.
About how to afford a Maserati.
I think that you should not buy the Maserati. So that's what this thing called denied is. Somebody comes in and they say, so they say, I want to buy a $400 pair of jeans. Okay, that's the last time I saw her. She listens very carefully. And then she says, denied. You can't buy that. So people tell their stories. And so this is financial advice. It's all about financial advice of people who are having a hard time meeting their expenditures. Okay. So this will... this will show what she does. Okay, so her most popular book is called The 9 Steps to Financial Freedom, Practical and Spiritual Steps So You Can Stop Worrying. So this is something like you should make rules for yourself. That's the basic thing, and then you should stick to them. Reasonable rules, okay? So let's contrast what she tells us there with the portrait given of consumer spending in the economics textbooks. According to economics textbooks, as you all know, we decide on our demand for the proverbial apples and oranges by having a budget for our spending. And then we choose the combination of apples and oranges that we buy that was going to maximize our happiness, the top highest utility function. But the remarkable thing, and I think this will also help, help understand what she does, the remarkable thing about Susie Orman's financial advice book is they tell us that consumers do not follow such a textbook protocol in their purchases. So how could, in my view, as I'm an economist, this is how I would behave according to the textbook way. You go to the store and you just buy the apples and oranges, you maximize your utility. So how could anyone do anything different? Well, Orman tells us that people have emotional hang-ups with regard to money and also with regard to spending it. And she says they're not honest with themselves. And as a consequence, they do not engage in rational budgeting. So the question is, how could she know? But we don't know that from any economics textbook. Well, fact is, she was a financial advisor, and she had a test. What she did was, she asked her advisees to add up their expenditures, and those expenditures were all but invariably fall short of what a documented account from the records would later turn up. So figuratively, relative to the proverbial trip to the supermarket to buy apples and oranges, it's as if her advisees spend too much in the fruit section, and then by the time they reach dairy products, there's nothing left over for eggs and milk. Okay. So in real life, such budgetary failure translates into having left over for savings at the end of the month. Okay. So this failure to deal cognitively and emotionally with money, says Orman, is what leads to all those unpaid bills. So it's her mission. That's why, in fact, these audiences really are listening to her, because she really does have something to tell them. It's her mission to keep those bills down so that her readers and her clients will no longer worry at night. So that worrying is in the title for a good reason. So that's the role of mommy. So that's why they'll allow it, and also why this audience is excused that mommy knows Wes' voice. So it's worth noting here, more than parenthetically, that worries, as noted in the subtitle, are central. They're central concerns of the financial advice books. But you're not going to find that in the economics textbooks. Okay, so let's give a statistical portrait to see whether, in fact, there might be some truth to her view of the world. So we can put together a statistical story which indicates that a very significant fraction of consumers are worried about how they're going to make ends meet. Okay? So now I'm going to give this statistical portrait that indicates there's really some merit to her argument. So there's a paper by Anna Maria Lusardi and co-authors, and they took a questionnaire and they asked the following question. How confident of America, this is of US, how confident are you that you would come up with $2,000 if an unexpected need arose within the next month? And almost 50% of U.S. respondents replied either that they could not or they probably could not come up with the needed $2,000. The same difficulties regarding finances can be gleaned from the survey of consumer finances, so we can see this. In 2004, according to standard survey sources, which is the Federal Reserve, the bottom half of all households had an average net worth of $23,000. Of that, a rough accounting indicates an average of about $10,000 of financial assets, most of which was, of course, already tied up in some illiquid form or some semi-illiquid form. Divorce statistics give a similar picture of divorcing couples. Past data on divorcing couples show that their average value of assets was less than $25,000 in inflation in adjusted dollars. So there's all this thing about no-fault divorce. The problem was that, well, one should have no-fault divorce, probably. But the problem was that people didn't have any assets over which to argue about who had the fault and who didn't. And these are data that's taken from court records. You would think that the people who are divorcing without much court record, that they wouldn't have gotten into the sample. Then we get a similar picture on expenditures relative to payday. So this is British data. For British workers who are paid once a month, their expenditures are down a remarkable 20% on average by the time they're about to receive their next paycheck. So you have to, I mean, I've done that myself. So you wait until you're just before payday, and then you before you increase your expenditure. And then we have the number of bankruptcies. So I made a computation based upon current bankrupt statistics as to what was the probable fraction of U.S. families which would experience a bankruptcy over their lifetime. And the answer is something like a 20 to 25% chance that somebody in the U.S. will go bankrupt over the course of their lifetime. Okay, so this poses a problem. Okay, The Susie Orman view of the world suggests that people are spending too much and they're worried as a result. So that leads to the question, why? And then there's another perspective on this. So back in 1930, Keynes wrote a short essay, which you may know, on what life would be like for our grandchildren, presumably some 100 years hence. Now, in one respect, he was totally correct. He predicted that real income would be some 8 times higher. So far, income has increased by 6 times, and so he's right on target at 2% growth for 2030. But there was another respect in which Keynes was totally off the mark. He did not predict that the grandchildren would be going to bed worried about their next shilling. Instead, he said that they would be worrying about how to use their surfeit of leisure. He said the work week would fall to 15 hours, which I'm sure most of us have not noticed. And he especially failed to predict the housewife who was exhausted from the first shift and then had to go on to the second shift. But the perspective of this book, our book, coupled with listening to Susie Orman, it gives us the reason for this. So let's go into that. In the U.S., the goal of almost every business person is to get you to spend your money. You're just not in business if you don't want to get people, customers, coming in spending their money. So life is a proverbial trip to a parking lot in which you're constantly passing spaces left open for the disabled. So life in a capitalist economy is then a continual temptation. So just think about it. Walk down a city street. The shop windows are literally there to make you come in and buy. That's what a city street is all about. There's something wonderful about that, but the real problem is maybe some people come in like Susie Orman's people and they simply buy too much. So there's even a nice song about that. There's this song, I don't know if you know this song, about how much is that doggy in the window, you know? So how much is that doggy in the window? So this nice young woman is walking past the store, and there are these little puppies out there in the window. That's the way dog stores used to be. And what did she do? She decides she's going to go in, and she's going to buy this doggy. And so according to the song, she does. And you know what she's going to do with that doggy? She has a boyfriend back home, back in her apartment. And what she's going to do is she's going to give her boyfriend the doggy. And she's going to California. So anyway. But anyway, going back to the lecture, in the shopping mall, one does simply not literally walk down the street looking in the windows, but there are all those temptations. They are arranged precisely to get you to buy. And in the supermarket, temptation is there. So these invitations, these attempts to lure us, they're simply pervasive. And they extend when we rent an apartment, when we buy a car, etc. So that's the way we are. Now, consumer advocates are typically worried. They're worried about credit cards and their effects. You've probably seen a lot of stuff. Well, there's good evidence that credit cards lead people to spend more. I believe that. But the idea of tempting the consumer to spend her money, is much more general and is in the very nature of free market capitalism. Okay, so I guess I'm beginning to run over time. But I want to make a remark. So I'm sort of in the middle of writing this book, and I'm giving you sort of... One of the problems here, so this gives one of the problems with fishing for fools, one serious problem. But then there's another problem, too, and that is what I was thinking about here is, in the Susie Orman thing, is we have all these consumers who are not being sufficiently careful, and they should have more money in their bank accounts, just a little bit more liquidity, and it would make a very big difference in their lives rather than ending up against the bills on the credit card and coming to the constraint at the other end of the month. There's another way in which this is probably going to play a huge role in terms of how we live. This book is mainly based on the U.S. because I want to stick to what I know best. But I'm pretty sure I can say this for the U.S. So, I think almost everybody thinks that global warming is really a serious problem. It's really a serious problem coming down the road. And as economists, we probably think that there's a pretty easy solution to global warming. The solution to global warming is just raise taxes on the use of carbon. And, you know, from the public, there is so much pushback to that it's just simply unthinkable. No politician thinks that they can even mention it. A lot of them don't even think they can believe that global warming exists, much less the idea that you'd put on a gasoline tax. Now, why do we not have a gasoline tax? Well, I think the reason we don't have a gasoline tax is simply, and taxes on other uses of carbon, is simply because people are in the Susie Orman mode, that people end up at the end of the month, and what's a relatively small amount of money relative to the budgets is something that they simply can't imagine giving up. And for some reason or other, especially the tax on gasoline is especially salient to them, and so it becomes difficult. So this problem, you know, I was thinking of this as a first-order problem with a large number of people's lives, like, let's say, these 20 to 25% of people who go bankrupt. But then in addition, because you have people who are so pressed, that means that we can't have rationality in terms of our public debate, and here it's very important. Okay, so that was just a bit of propaganda piece. Let's go on to the next one. Okay, so now we go on to the next chapter, which is the financial crisis. And I'm going to be very brief here and going to give you a brief picture of the financial crisis. So there are hundreds of books on the financial crisis, and the typical one is 500 pages long. And they're wonderful. I love these books. The typical one tells the story of my institution. For example, it's Lehman, or it's Goldman Sachs, or it's Fannie May, Freddie Mac, or it's the Fed, or the Treasury, or Bank of America, or Citicorp. And implicit in all these books is that my institution is central to the crisis, and that's why you should read my book. Okay. The aim of this chapter here is to do the opposite. It's to explain the financial crisis in, let's say, 12 pages. Okay? And so is to tell the story of the crisis in general terms. So you scratch any economist, and what we do is we go into economics speak. So we're trained to think in terms like supply and demand. This means that we often ask very good questions, and we have good analyses of problems. So fishing for fools is an offshoot from how we standard economists typically do our analysis. This is how any economist thinks. But it turns out it's not so standard that every economist was asking the right questions in the build-up to the crisis, but we should have been. Why? Because fishing for fools gives an extremely succinct explanation for what happened. And I'm going to give you one rendition of that, okay? So here's the simplest rendition. If I have a reputation for selling perfect, beautiful avocados, I have an opportunity. I can sell you a rotten avocado at the price you would pay for the perfect ripe one. I will have mined my reputation, but I will have also fished you for a fool. Okay? So that's the basic principle. That's actually the four-line statement of what happened in the financial crisis. Now we'll tell this story in a little bit more detail. Such a story lies at the heart of the continuing financial crisis that dominates the economics of our times. The reputation mining in question involved the subversion of the system of rating fixed income securities. So the reputations of Moody's and Standard & Poor's had been built up over the course of almost a century. They were taken very seriously by lots of people like you and me, people who didn't want to spend their lives in really examining what was in detail in the securities. We could take the ratings. So their job was to rate bonds on their probability of default. Then in the late 1990s and early 2000s, the ratings agencies took on themselves the task not just of rating bonds, but of also rating more complex derivative securities. The complexity of the payment structures made those securities hard to rate. But something else made the ratings all but impossible. the underlying assets, such as the mortgages, were inaccessible to the raiders. But the public would believe whatever ratings were given to them by the agencies. And so an industry grew up. An industry grew up simply to do a reputation mod. Okay, so what happened? By analogy, rotten avocados were being labeled perfect. With that label, they commanded premium prices. So a whole Central Valley full of growers went into the profitable business of producing such avocados. So this mining of the ratings is the basic story of the financial crisis. So what they didn't grow avocados. What they did was they grew houses in the Central Valley on which they, quote, they sold. There were mortgages. And then those mortgages were transferred to New York and given the perfect rating, the perfect avocado, and then they were sold on in once they were in these packages as if they were perfect because the ratings agency had done that. So that's not quite all of the explanation. There's a little bit more, but you add this little bit more, and then you should know a financial crisis was certain to occur. So we must also explain why the production and sales of these overrated securities, or these overrated avocados, brought down the financial sector. Let's see. The answer, again, is simple. The values of these securities reflected their ratings. That enabled commercial banks and investment banks and also hedge funds to borrow huge amounts of money short-term, invest in the overrated securities, and pocket small profits from the interest spread on every dollar of investment. They took on then a lot of leverage. That borrowing was made with the rotten securities as collateral. For the moment, it seemed as if this was as good as gold. The ratings even indicate that there was almost no chance of default. But then, of course, we know what happened. The truth was discovered. These avocados, perfect as they were on the outside, were really rotten on the inside. They were worth much less than the bankers and the finance managers had paid for them. And we know that from Frankfurt to New York to Reykjavik, that financial institutions owed much more than they owned. And without bailout, they were going to be bankrupt. And when they were bankrupt, they were going to bring down the whole world financial system. Okay, so I'm going through the book. I'll give you what we do more in the chapter. The chapter then gives the historical answers to four questions. How had the ratings agencies initially established their reputation? One. What then changed, making it more profitable to mine that reputation than to keep it? Why were the buyers of those rotten securities so naive? And why was the financial system so vulnerable to the discovery that the assets were rotten? Okay, so I guess I'm beginning to talk too long. I'll just give you a summary of what's going through the book. Actually, I finished almost a first draft of almost this. So one is the savings and loan crisis and looting, the role of advertising, mortgages and credit cards, lobbying. Lobbying is very important in all of this because that's one of the reasons that we don't have sufficient regulation or we don't have sufficient taxes on the things that people are doing. Then there's the review of the literature, which I had thought I might have time to go into to explain why this, where this places in the economics literature. And then we talk. So I've said we're saying all these bad things about our own economy. If there's a chapter which looks at what happened in socialist economies, and you should be very happy you're here where you are now. And then there's a conclusion. Okay, so let me take some questions. Thank you.